show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! We go 3 minutes past the hour. This is the Horn, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. That's our home. This is Friday on the Front Porch for the 19th day of September 2014. Of course, Friday on the Front Porch is dedicated to a rousing roundtable discussion of extraordinarily ordinary Americans. You know, the folks who are experts, the real experts in this country, at carrying this country on their backs, which is what the working class does in this country. And with damned little help into the bargain, I might add. Right off the bat, happy birthday to our buddy Larry. Larry has a birthday today, and we hope you celebrate it admirably, Larry. And congratulations to M. Brandt, who just informed me in the chat room that he has completed his schooling. Well, you're all larned up now. No excuses, right? Yeah, head on RadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room where M. Brandt is and where Anatole is and where Stockton Larry, who is not Larry with the birthday right now, or at any time, for that matter. And Texas DR, many more people will be wandering by as the evening progresses. And we're looking for much good conversation and merriment. Had a great conversation with first-time caller Todd last night. Thanks, Todd, for a whole bunch of different topics. It was much appreciated and I think much enjoyed by all and sundry who chimed in. So, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Okay, check that one off the list. Yeah, if you enjoy what you hear on the Horn, please understand that this happens, this is a community effort. There are no million-dollar salaries here. We joke about the hangar rent for the Gulfstream 5, but in point of fact, there's no Gulfstream 5 and there's no hangar. We talk about Agnes's masseur, but, well, he's imaginary. So's the cabana boy and the groundskeeper and the chef de cuisine. They're all imaginary because this is, in fact, a purely working-class effort. And toward that end, we try to raise the paltry sum of $150 every evening. Last couple of evenings have been kind of thin, but we did get some help, and for that help, we are mightily appreciative. Thank you, Khalil, and thank you very much to Paul. And toward the end of the program last night, well, thank you to Ralphs. Thank you kindly, Ralphs. And let's see. Well, that leaves us with a fundraising goal this evening of $235. $235. $23 folks, $10 apiece. Can it be done? Might it be done? Dare we hope it will be done? Well, we better by God hope, or, well, because, you see, we are approaching. Now, my return to radio and my creation of progressive liberal radio here in West Bicol, Virginia, goes back to 2003, but we are approaching the 10th anniversary. I mean, not the 10th anniversary. We are approaching the 9th online anniversary of this online-only effort. Yeah, that's coming up next month. 10 years of the actual horn we passed in February. And that has been, that is an inspiring date. Because that means that for, 9 years now, this has been going because you decide that it will. Because you've decided that it's worth keeping going, that you appreciate this community, this little family commune congregation that we've pulled together and made for ourselves. So when we talk about trying to raise $150 in an evening, or when we're in a hole, $235, that's what we're talking about keeping going. And, of course, there are incentives for those who wish to participate. This is the 19th of September here, but it's actually the 20th of September up over down under in Australia. And that means that we have the that means that we have the 20th of the month up over down under challenge, courtesy of our good friend Robert. Now, what that means, and Robert is one of those recurring challenge pillars of the Horn Family Commune Congregation community. Robert noting, the Friday community discussion will be on the 19th in the U.S. It will, however, be the 20th here in Oz. So it's time for the 20th of the month up over down under challenge. $100 is on the table, and that's a big deal because of the hole we're in. So that's 100 people at a buck each, 50 people at $2 each. Robert's trying to save me the trouble of burning up my little brain cells doing math. 33 people at $3 each plus one person at a dollar. 25 people at $4 each, 20 at $5, 16 at $6 each, and 4 people at $1, 14 people at $7 each, and 2 people at $1, 12 people at $8 each, and 4 people at $1, 11 people at $9 each, and 1 person at $1, and finally 10 people at $10 each, or 1 person matches my $100 with $100. Any of these, says Robert, would be wonderful. And then 90 people need to give a dollar each. It can be done. Robert, living in Oz. Thank you, Robert. Thank you for being there every month, and thank you for constantly providing this challenge. So, by obviously whatever combination that $100 rolls in, Robert will match it. Now, if somebody does come up with the $100, and I would gladly send the gift basket or the smoky ghost pepper cheese to Oz, it just won't make the trip. But for anyone who wants to kick in $100, Sparky is out there willing to reward you with your choice of pistachios grown right there in that neck of the woods where Sparky liveth, or smoky ghost pepper cheese, which will light up your life more than Debbie Boone ever did. Also on the table for $75, a $75 contribution, Carol will put together a mid-American treat. The Ozark gift basket, which consists of a beef stick, locally made, also known sometimes as summer sausage. Your choice of spicy buffalo cheddar, or hellaciously hot Caribbean Monterey Jack, plus, yes indeed, plus a jar of magnificent, she swears, magnificent elderberry jam from the Missouri River Valley. So that's a $75 contribution. You know, we're not selling anything. These are just premiums for participation. If you want to go that route, by all means, just let me know. and give me your address and tell me what your preference is. I will transmit it to, depending on your choice, either Carol or to Sparky, and it will be on the way. Thanks very much to Henry and to Asa. We are well on the way toward meeting Robert's Up Over Down Under's challenge. There are $70 remaining now in that challenge. Let's see. Well, obviously, I guess we have to talk about, we don't have to, but I find it interesting. My heritage lies in that direction, so I watch the Scottish independence vote with some interest, and, well, the people have spoken. God damn them. To whom was attributed that great quote? Some politician? I don't remember. But now apparently the full court press that was put on by the dream team of the British Parliament, being the Speaker and the opposition and the dude from the Liberal Democrats, succeeded. The Scots have chosen to remain in the United Kingdom with England. And that's okay, I guess. I mean, I'm not so invested in it that I'm sitting over here, painting myself blue and screaming freedom. No. So, if you have any thoughts on that, you are welcome to bring them to the table. Or on any number of other topics. You know, I go back to the note that we got from Kate last night during the deconstruction of the pathetic cry for help of Sean Hannity. My daddy hit me in the face and I'm okay. Daddy! And Kate saw a disconnect between a discussion of that kind of domestic violence. And by the way, my apologies to anyone, and this is just a sort of standing apology, I guess. My apologies to anyone for whom that kind of discussion serves as a trigger. Because I don't want anybody to suffer because of or relive or be re-terrorized or horrified as a result of what we talk about here. I probably should have issued a trigger warning for what it was worth. I thought Kate offered a valid critique of the discussion. You may recall she said, "I'm wondering how the subject has such traction while the Congress are voting today on whether or not to arm someone in the Middle East when it will assuredly mean the killing of children." What the f- right? And I shared that last night on the air. And my take on that was that there is no disconnect. That a nation that can't understand that it ought not beat its children is going to have a hard time understanding that it ought not blow someone else's children up too. Didn't see Sweden participating in the coalition of the billing back there in 2003. Now, did you? Nope. Kate continued last night, though, the part that I did not share. She said, "This conversation brings back too many bad memories, hence my apology for the trigger. I didn't deserve not one of the strappings that I got as a child. The leather was bad enough, but the metal on the other end brought blood. At least the subject is educating folks as to what a switch is. Just like Monica and Bill opened up a whole new dialogue among the uneducated." And education, I suppose, is never a waste. But I'm the Congress is gone now. Can you imagine that? They've got themselves a 2-month vacation in jobs that they barely do, for which they are paid in sometimes in excess of $200,000 a year. Stunning, isn't it? They have the best socialized medicine that this country can offer. They have payment for per diems and for housing allowance. They have huge staffs. And a pension that us working schlubs can only dream of. And they're on vacation. They're on vacation because it's an election year, and of course, if you ask them, they'll tell you they're actually working because they're campaigning. The only problem is campaigning in 2014 American political speak means getting on the phone to donors, especially if you're a member of the right-wing or pig-licking majority in the House. Hell, they're not even doing town halls anymore, are they? That got a little dodgy. Would you define rape for us? I'll be happy to. Oh, shut up! Hey, Congressman Brown, what about science? Lies from the pits of hell! Yeah, you can see how that plays. This is inspiring. Thank you very kindly to Glenn and to our good friend Luta. We are now at $50 toward the $100 challenge, the up over down under challenge posited and put upon the table by Robert in Australia. Luta says, since it's doubling my gold, I'll chip in a bit. Hope it helps. Just one request. All the news over the past week have been nothing but the NFL. I can't take it anymore. Can we please talk about something else? That was my plan. That's where I was going. The Congress having, of course, voted to get our war on by arming Syrian rebels that we don't really know who they are, except we know that we wouldn't want to have them to dinner, and we're going to arm them there so we don't have to fight them here. You know, if you're John Boehner, maybe that makes sense if you've got your swirly straw in the bottle of cheap screw top Merlot. I don't know. Did anybody ever get around to looking to see who the 22 Democrats were, the 22 senators were, because some of them were pig-lickings, who voted against the Get Your War On bill yesterday? I confess that it was on my list to do, but I did not. That would be, I think, interesting to have for our examination. We've got that discussion as a possibility. Oh, yeah, Carol noting via Skype chat as to my reference to the town hall meeting. She said, our town hall meetings were by invitation only. Keeps the riffraff like me out. And by riffraff, we mean anybody who might ask an unpleasant question. And by unpleasant question, we mean anything except the general questions along the lines of, how much do you love Jesus? No, really, you love Jesus that much? It's about the only question a right-wing, pig-licking, teabagging, birther, deather, tenther, booger-eater, John Bircher, libertarian, Congress type wants to hear. So they had a meeting, now that the Congress has voted to let that one in our White House, President not sure, get his war on. But we shouldn't say get his war on, that's get our war on. Because unlike the right wing, I refuse to distinguish between the American people and the American government, because the operating the operating philosophy behind the formation of that government is that there is no distinction. The people are the government, and the government are the people. Now, as I have noted in the past, one of the more successful right-wing Republican tactics of the last couple of generations, really, is to destroy that notion, to set up the government as a them to which the noble, freedom-loving, freedom-protecting Wolverines, Republicans, stand in opposition. But it doesn't matter. That's the thing about lies. Now, the big lie theory says that if you tell a lie often enough, it becomes the truth. But that is perceptionally only. Facts remain facts, and the facts are that this government was formed to be an expression of popular will, not an imposition of sovereign rule. And so it is, whatever we do, our war. Your war. My war. Done in your name, my name, our name. The bombs that fall and wind up with daddies and mommies carrying the constituent parts of their little children out of some housing structure largely indifferable from the same way stuff has been built over there for the last 5,000 years, that's on you. That's on me. And consequently, it becomes incumbent upon us, if we object to it, to somehow voice that objection, which I have been doing. I admit that my form of manifesting my objection has been roughly the equivalent of shouting into a rain barrel, but at least I know that I've registered it. And of course, the other tangentially another discussion possible for the evening is the coming People's Climate March in New York City this weekend, which I support generally. Not going to be there. I have mixed feelings about whether I should be there. I acknowledge, as we all do here, the reality of climate change. We live in reality world. But I am focused and fixated on the AIC Act and on the very real climate change-inducing actions that are taking place right here where I am. One of the side effects of Congress bugging out as if somebody had just found that, well, it's like some sort of farmer's daughter joke. See you later. You know, as Congress runs off into the sunset in its long underwear with its pants and shirt strewn across its shoulders and trying to haul its boots onto its foot as it hops along, having just leapt out a second-story window. Well, them bugging out, we had actually planned, my colleague Bo and I had planned a D.C. trip to do some AIC work at the end of September. Ain't gonna happen. Now we go back whenever the Congress comes back. There's some work you can get done while they're gone. There's some that you can't. And that's so. I don't know. I think a conversation about the People's Climate March is in order. I've been reading both pros and cons about it. Their goal is to make it the biggest climate-based or climate issue march, gathering, protest the world has ever known. Whether they succeed or not, I don't know. I know big greens have been hiring buses for all they're worth to get people across the country from all over to New York City. And just because I guess I'm kind of curmudgeonly, I got to thinking about how almost all those buses are run on diesel fuel. I'm not getting all right-wingy here. I want you to understand. I'm not. But those buses are run on diesel fuel, and that means a whole bunch of ultra-fine particulate matter being pumped into the atmosphere, more so than otherwise would be. It's some sort of a bump. And because y'all are you and I'm me and we have the conversations we have, we know what the effect of ultrafine particulate matter are. But that's not to say that it shouldn't happen. It is to say that there is that when you are in a society as deeply embedded with hydrocarbon fuels as this one is and as the global one is, well, it just kind of goes to show how co-opted we all are. No matter how thoroughly we understand how toxic and how dangerous heating up this planet is, to one degree or another, we all have to participate in that heating because it is ubiquitous. It is inescapable. That's one of the things that motivates me as I try to pull together some sort of a crowdfunding campaign that will bring solar power here so as to make the Horn the first progressive radio network able to say this radio program, this broadcast was created without blowing up any mountains or poisoning any mountain communities. Because sometimes it just sticks in your craw, or at least mine. Ah, thank you very kindly, Robert. Robert in Morgantown has kindly checked out the vote tally. There was a split in the West Virginia Senate on the vote yesterday. For all the wrong reasons, my senator, Jay Rockefeller, voted yes to get our war on. And Joe Manchin, wrong, right for all the wrong reasons, voted no. Because you got to understand why I say that. If Barack Obama had wanted a resolution saying no war, Joe Manchin would have voted pro-war. Whatever the Kenyan Muslim usurper with the deep-seated hatred of white people and anti-colonialist tendencies wants, Joe Manchin knows he has to vote against it back here, or the friends of coal will get right uppity with him. And all those West Virginians who provided the data which statistically suggest we are the most racist state in the nation by looking at on a per capita basis far more often than any other state in the union for the word Barack Obama, words Barack Obama and N-I-G-G-E-R, well, they'd be upset with him too. And even if he's not sure he wants to be a senator for much longer, Joe Manchin would sure like to come back and be governor, and he knows he's got to keep the Klan and the Klan auxiliary and the Klan reserve that constitutes a big part of the West Virginia's population in his pocket. So you see how that works. Sure. Oh, well. But in the wake of the congressional vote, they had a little tete-a-tete in the UN Security Council today. Agence France-Presse reporting that the UN Security Council had a sit-down, and the meeting, they let John Kerry chair the meeting, which sadly means that most of the member nations' representatives may well have been asleep and just sort of flung their arms in the air. 35 countries attended the meeting, 15 had votes. My, isn't that some global democracy? Did you ever stop to consider what a nasty bit of anti-democratic privilege the UN Security Council itself is? Or the idea that it has permanent members and that we're one and Britain's another? See, white people, white people. Russia's another white people. You get the idea. And a vote from any of those white countries, is France a permanent member? White people. Can put the kibosh on anything? My goodness. Ain't democracy grand? Now, John Kerry chaired the meeting. And the Security Council issued a statement, which is about the most that the Security Council can do. And the Security Council said, "This large-scale offensive poses a major threat to the region." And they also issued a statement of support for the new Iraqi government, calling on the international community to maintain security and combat terrorism and to create a safe, stable, and prosperous future for the people of Iraq. Oh, I'm sorry, I went to sleep there. So now we've got the UN Security Council's, I don't guess this is sanction. This doesn't necessarily say that they approve of us getting our war on, you and me, but that they would like for ISIL not to become the operative government of Iraq. Because, I mean, we don't necessarily know those people. And we're not sure that they would give us access to their oil. Oh, you cynical ass! Come on, it's all about oil, isn't it? It kind of has to be, doesn't it? So Congress has returned from its... God almighty... I can hardly stand to say it. Congress has returned from its August recess, a month off, to hang around for a couple of days and swill a few martinis and eat a couple of chilled shrimp, and they're on vacation again. They're on vacation while an entirely not ready to believe it military structure. And by that, I mean moms and dads and brothers and sisters and daughters and sons and aunts and uncles and cousins. And you know, because the military have families, are all sitting around wondering, well, we thought we dodged it. And then there are other families who are like, we didn't dodge it. We didn't, no. We go to the cemetery regularly to visit our loved one who didn't make it back. The ones who did are thinking, hey, we thought this was over. But you see, in a world that is run by hydrocarbon industries, you see how they dovetail together? You see how climate change and climate crisis finds a way to enter into questions of war and peace and mayhem and death? Well, it does. Because there's not a place on this planet that has oil coming out of it where we can afford to go without the oil. This is a culture that is perilously perched on a petroleum precipice. Do I get a cookie for that? It is. We got to have every damn drop. There ain't no conservation. India has an actual growing middle class. China has an emerging middle class. They all want cars. They want the Western lifestyle. Well, you know, minus the frozen dinners, maybe. But they do. They've watched us for years partying our brains out. And they'd like a couple of party hats and some funny hats and some noisemakers too. So we gotta have a reliable flow of oil coming out of Iraq. And we're not gonna even look cross-eyed at Saudi Arabia, because that's gotta stay reliable too. And it's a tough nut to crack for the right wingers, because they really want to nuke Iran, but Iran has a bunch of oil as well. And then there's the Caspian Sea basin. And then there's the Chinese have apparently discovered shale gas under the seabed of the China Sea. Did I catch that right? And we've got to have it all. Because behind all of those nations wanting all of that oil, and that goes without saying, the traditional nations that have been burning most of it for the last 100 years and heating up the planet, we don't want to slack off. We're not going to back off our oil consumption so the Indians and the Chinese can have a heyday. I mean, we're America, right? And so behind all of the nations wanting all of that oil, there are oil companies. And they are the true government of the world. Now, this is not the part of the program where I secretly morph into Glenn Beckerhead and start telling you to buy seeds and gold and magic bean water purification tat. No. But we do have to live in reality world now, don't we? And this is it. We will go anywhere, fight anyone, kill as need be, until the gore rises to our knees, if need be, to maintain access to that poisonous goo, the combustion of which raises the question as to whether or not this species will remain a viable species upon this planet. I mean, I hope that presents a fairly a fairly concise picture of the situation. Irish Dave with a soupçon of difference of opinion. Irish Dave says, "Nah, Bob, we don't need to have it all as long as we have the power to determine who gets it and what price, too, also." Well, that's what those corporations are for. So true. And there's the logical question coming from Robert in Morgantown. Bob, why are we going to fight ISIL when Saudi Arabia has the fourth largest military force in the world? You're not going to like the answer. We're going to do that because, A, the Saudis feel like they are too good to let their blood, when they could just as easily let their heathen fellahin, the Americans, do it for them. They have no respect for us. They sneer at us. We are not as good as them. But secondly, and perhaps this is more like firstly, I suspect that the Saudi Arabian royal family does not trust its own military. The Saudi royal family isn't sure how many in its military ranks agree more with ISIL than they do with the royal house of Ibn Saud. They might just decide to march their happy asses out into the desert to put down ISIL, and the next thing you know, the army's turned around and marching back on Mecca. Wouldn't be the first time. And culturally, one goal has been to make Saudi Arabia a kind of inviolable place so that various and sundry Arab armies wouldn't march on Mecca. See how it works? It's one thing to have the fourth largest army in the world. It's another thing to have that fourth largest army be maybe the fourth best. And I'll bet you the Saudis aren't. Now, we've sold them a lot of good gimcracks and door, you know, various and sundry heavy explosive military doorstops. But as the Iraqi army proved when it started tearing its shoes off and shirts and pants and dropping its guns and running into the night away from ISIL, having the hardware isn't nearly as important as having the heart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, for those of you who are into reading stuff, and a lot of you are, I'm in the middle of an absolutely fascinating book over on my Kindle thingy by J.E. Linden. It's called Soldiers and Ghosts, A History of Battle in Classical Antiquity. And you know what a nerd I am. I think that you can look at classical antiquity and see, you know, through a mirror darkly, images of ourselves. And one of the things, I'm fairly early in the book, but one of the things that the author points out is that one of the reasons that the ancient Greek phalanx structure evolves is as a means of keeping soldiers from running away from battle. and you know what the phalanx was. It was quite effective, too. But along the way, the Greeks decided that archers and javelin types were just not sporting, because it was all about arete, if I'm pronouncing that right. Arete. Courage. Honor. Excellence. Agathos? Something like that. And they determined that was best able to be verified inside the phalanx structure, as opposed to having a whole bunch of Homeric heroes running around doing individual combat and flitting to and fro and being excellent at each other, and worst of all, having a really excellent soldier, hoplite, that was the word, taken down by an anonymous and indiscriminately fired arrow. Because they had this notion that there was something honorable about going to war. Well, we don't have any such niceties left. And you can't pack a whole bunch of people toting semi-automatic weapons into a phalanx and march them forward. For all intents and purposes, mechanized modern warfare is all archers and all javelin chuckers. Because it's all distance killing via firearm. And planes, and drones, and artillery, and Tomahawk cruise missiles launched from submarines 600, 700 miles away. The ancient Greeks would be horrified by the way we wage war, because they would see no honor in it, no opportunity for excellence, no opportunity for bravery or demonstrations of courage. And most of all, the wholesale percentage of the wasting of those who have those qualities by the anonymity of a randomly fired bullet. That book is quite good, and for those who are interested in the topic, I recommend it. So those are some of the topics that are out there for our consideration. Reuters has another one. Once again, someone is running around asking questions of people who probably have a hard time tying their shoelaces in the morning. Not because of physical limitations either, I might add. Reuters commissioned a poll with Ipsos in which they asked, in the wake of the Scottish decision to remain a part of the United Kingdom, they decided to run around America asking people with breakfast beverage bags hanging from their hats how they felt. The poll was conducted from August the 23rd through September the 16th for release in the event, you know, regardless of the outcome of the Scottish referendum, for release concomitant with that. And 23.9% of the American respondents to this Reuters Ipsos poll said they'd kind of like to secede. They outright said they prefer secession. Meanwhile, 53.3% of the 8,952 people Reuters and Ipsos queried said they either strongly opposed or tended to oppose the notion. I, meanwhile, am looking for the Andrew Jackson contingent in that poll, I guess I would fall under strongly opposed. You know, it was Andrew Jackson who said that he would personally get on his horse and hie himself hence to South Carolina and hang the first secessionist he met, and as quick as that one was good and dead, he'd get his rope and go and hang the next one. And that was how Andrew Jackson put down the secession debate for another 20 years or so. Less than 20. Not surprisingly, Republicans and residents of rural western states have secession fever more than do Democrats and Northeasterners. Roy Gustafson is 61 years old and comes from Camden, South Carolina. He survives on disability payments. Roy Gustafson, who manages to make it to the mailbox once a month to pick up his disability payment from the federal government, said, "Well, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference anymore which political party is running things. Nothing gets done. The state would be better off handling things on its own." Oh, Roy, you dumbass. You wouldn't make it to 65 if South Carolina was handling things on its own. Because South Carolina just as soon see your sorry ass die. You 61, you ain't useful to anybody anymore. You's a useless eater now, Roy Gustafson. Just get along now and die. Dainty little Lindsey Graham crack ain't even gonna come to your funeral. Mm-mm. Can you imagine the state of South Carolina trying to handle, as Roy Gustafson puts it, disability payments? Mr. Speaker, the chair recognizes the man from Boogersnot, South Carolina. Mr. Speaker, I rise in opposition to the notion that we would provide disability payments. Disability is a liberal, politically correct word to describe people who refuse to work, who refuse to raise themselves on their own bootstraps. And I will not see the liberty of this here great state besmirched by layabouts of 61 years who won't get out there and earn their own way in freedom. Harumph, 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 harumph. Oh, Jesus. And please understand that although Roy Gustafson, 61, of Camden, South Carolina, is the only one being quoted there, that could be echoed all across the Confederacy. From South Carolina Stan to Alabama Stan to Mississippi Stan to Tennessee Stan to Arkansas Stan, and even up into some of the states of the old Union, Talibandiana, even, sad to say it, Wisconsin Stan. It really galls me to hang the Stan on the end of the name of Wisconsin. Maybe I should not say that. Maybe because there is such brilliant opposition taking place there, there's a chance that they will back away from the abyss. Maybe they'll toss Scott Walker out on his ass. Or maybe he'll get indicted before they even get a chance. Then, of course, according to Reuters, there is Brittany Royal, Brittany Royal is 31 years old. She's a nurse from Wilkesboro, North Carolina. She said, Obamacare has really hurt a lot of people here, myself included. My insurance went from $40 a week for a family of four up to over $600 a month for a family of four. The North Carolina government itself is sustainable. Governor McCrory, I think, has a better health care plan than President Obama.
Of course, Governor McCrory's health care plan is die quickly. And I kind of think that Brittany Royal, 31-year-old nurse from Wilkesboro, North Carolina, probably lying about that $600 premium. And bless their hearts. Bless their hearts. We know where true patriotism lieth in this here country. It lays where it was born. And it may be where it dies. The shot heard round the world was fired at Lexington and Concord in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the states gathered together, generally referred to as New England, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. Did I miss any? They want nothing to do with secession. They never did. Maybe they never will. Only 17.4% of the people from New England who were surveyed even remotely supported the notion of secession in 2014, 150 years after we already had this goddamn discussion. The Reuters Ipsos poll noted that the concept was the most popular in the American Southwest, where the disease has spread from the Confederacy. 34.1% of respondents in the Southwest support the idea of secession. By Southwest, we mean Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada. Mark Denny's 59 years old, and he lives outside Dallas on disability payments. He said, Texas has everything we need. We have the manufacturing, we have the oil, and we don't need them. I have totally, completely lost faith in the federal government, the people running it, whether Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever. He is, of course, lying. He is a straight-ticket voting Republican. Never mind the fact that Texas could not survive for 15 minutes on its own, let alone permanently. Every interstate highway in Texas would be ground down to gravel inside of half a decade. Texas does not have everything it needs. Texas does not have the one thing it needs most, and that is good government. But they're all over the place, and like I said last night, they feel a privilege of telling you exactly how they feel while you sit there and go, where's the guy with the butterfly net? But in a place like Texas, even an alleged Democrat like Lila Guzman of Round Rock said, when I say secede, I'm not like Charlton Heston with my gun up in the air, my cold dead hands. It's more like we could do it if we had to. But the first option is, golly, get it back on the right track. Not all is lost, but there might come a point that we say, hey, y'all, we're dusting our hands and we're moving on. Lila Guzman is 62.
really, really feel like maybe I ought to take a deeper look at the polling data itself. Because I'd like to see if they asked anybody, say, younger than the age of 40. And at this point in the program, I will resist the urge to be a real prick and say, well, of course they did. And the answer was, dude, what? Because I know better. I know better. There are a lot of engaged young people because there are a lot of young people who know that their fat is in the fire. I hope to hell they go to the polls this time. And see, once again, that's another one of those disconnects of mine because I've been politically plugged in, I think, since I started understanding the English language entering my ears. So I don't understand disconnected people. I'm going to go, and who knows? We may have to revisit this story for more on Monday. Once I've gotten a closer look at the data. So there we are, the end of the filibobster for this Friday on the Front Porch. It's time for us to get our roundtable of extraordinary, ordinary Americans and other members, other citizens of the globe who may wish to chime in, into the conversation. Now, let's go over this again. If you want to be part of the conversation on Friday on the Front Porch, what you need to do is send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, on Skype. Sparky will then approve the contact, and you will be welcomed into the Extraordinary Ordinary American Roundtable. It's really easy. And you're welcome to participate. I think the bigger the group, the better the conversation we have. Okay, got a little affirmation coming from Michael in Madison. Subject line, Wisconsin Stan. Wisconsin Stan. Ooh, okay. Michael says, nah, Bob, feel free to shame us cheese curd eaters until such a time that we get our political shit back together, if, in fact, we ever do. Being in the North doesn't afford us any special right to be smug. Just ask our black youth who have worse outcomes here than just about anywhere in the country, including the evil South. While that's an issue I'm still learning about, my impression is that that bit of badger shame is not something that can be pinned solely on Governor Scotty, pile of shit that he is. My only suggestion would be to save yourself a syllable and call us Wisconsin. Yeah, kind of like Talibandiana. Thank you, Michael. And by way of offering a little bit of icky affirmation for Michael's affirmation, well, let's visit the chapter of Tau Kappa Epsilon at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The Milwaukee police are investigating the fraternity chapter of Tau Kappa Epsilon at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee after four people wound up at the hospital having apparently been dosed with a date rape drug. One student has already been arrested. Three women and one male were made sick. Don't worry, that's not... I'm sure Tau Kappa Epsilon at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee makes sure they don't have any gay members. That was a guy who actually accidentally drank from his date's glass. Here's where it gets even sicker, as if it is possible. I mean, this is pretty sick, just what I've already told you. The women who were to be dosed, according to police, were so indicated by having a red X drawn on the back of their hands by the bouncer at the door who was letting people into the Tau Kappa Epsilon Teak fraternity party. Police were called three times on Friday night last week to Sandberg Residence Hall at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the space of an hour and a half between midnight and 1:30 a.m. Every time they got called, they found female students who were unable to stand or walk, all of whom had red X's on their hands, and all of whom had been to the same teak party. This all according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. About 1:20 a.m., other police officers arrived at the fraternity house, where they found a bunch of students drinking and partying in the basement of the fraternity house, all of them underage. Police also noted several large piles of vomit and a copious number of empty alcohol containers in and about the lawn and the interior floors of the fraternity house. Might be time for the National Fraternity to pull the charter, because in 2013 alone, that chapter was investigated three times for sexual assault, resulting in no charges. At least the university has severed its ties with Teak, pending the outcome of the investigation. Jesus. And that's a separate discussion entirely. All of these fraternities, or almost all of them, were founded in or around the mid-19th century. They were founded by wealthy sons of, or wealthy-ish sons of privilege, either members of the planter class or the merchant class, at little colleges that dotted the Midwest. Places like Miami University of Ohio and Jefferson College of Pennsylvania and Washington College of Pennsylvania. And they were, each and all of them, founded as reading societies. Or most of them. They were founded as societies of young men with common interests who needed to get together to study together and talk about things like the proper declension of Greek nouns and conjugation of Latin verbs and the relative merits of Cicero versus Socrates. Many of them were religion students. And it has blossomed into this. Just as I said earlier, that the ancient Greeks would not understand, to a certain extent, the warfare as we manage it, so too the founders of those debating societies would not understand poisoning women in order to try to have sex with them. different time, different culture. And this is not a good old days kind of, no. Theoretically, at least, even the young men who join these organizations now still have to learn those initial guiding principles. For most of them, they matter not a damn. And the next question is, who's in charge of making sure we've got a working tap for the kegs? And it's sad and it's sorry. Marty noting, underage drinking on a college campus? Bob, I'm shocked. Not really. Of course, I never pledged to a fraternity. Slipping a Mickey Finn into somebody's drink, that's where I'll draw the line. Thanks. I think the founders of those outfits would have drawn the line well before you got to that. Irish Dave pointing out, you know, there really is an up south, you know. Michigan Stan, for instance, voted for George Wallace in big numbers in 1968. Now more than ever. And, of course, George Wallace was one of the early progenitors of the idea that there's not a dime's worth of difference between Republicans and Democrats, which would later be echoed by Ralph Nader, and which is often echoed by well-intended but not terribly politically astute. Well, never mind. So let's take a break. We have $45 to go on Robert's Up Over Down Under 19th of the Month Challenge, 20th of the month, really. And it would be great if we took care of that. And remember, there are two premiums remaining on the table. $75 contribution gets you Carol's Ozark gift basket, including a locally made delicious beef stick summer sausage, as well as your choice of either spicy buffalo cheddar or hot Caribbean Monterey Jack cheese, and a jar of absolutely scrumptious elderberry preserves. And for $100 via Sparky, your choice of either Northern California-grown pistachios or smoky ghost pepper cheese, which is, I promise you, hot and yummy. PayPal buttons at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Subject line, fraternities. Luda asks, Bob, do you think the investigation outcomes would have been turned out differently had they been Mexican or black fraternities or Muslim fraternities? Oh, scary. Rich white kids never pay the piper. I guess they're learning early that wealthy businessmen get bailouts, not jail. One kid has been arrested, and one hopes justice will be served. But yeah, it would have been. Oh, if it had been Kappa Alpha Psi or Alpha Kappa Alpha, it would have been wildly different. Hell, people might have gotten shot. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. So it's time to start the Friday on the Front Porch Horn Malloy Skype chat group roundtable of extraordinary ordinary Americans. Sparky tells me they're righteously ready to go. Again, hopefully you know how to get into that group if you wish to join in. We'll take a break and get it all set up and get rocking and rolling. It's about 16 minutes past the hour. Why don't you join in? Or barring that, if you can't get to the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, pop on over to the Horn chat room. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. You will be welcomed there by a madcap bunch of real-time conversationalists. All right. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
He's a new-fashioned imperialist. He may not have a mill, but he has a lot of grist. Chinese convict labor.
Jason Ringenberg's Empire Builders disc to be quite handy this week. From 2004, that is New Fashioned Imperialist. Oddly, I bet you already gathered that. Friday on the front porch on the Horn, 20 minutes past 7 p.m. here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. And we have the Horn Molloy Skype chat group gathered together, at least a few of us so far. Good evening, Sparky.
Good evening, Bob.
How in the world are you?
I'm just fine. Carol said she had a scratchy throat tonight. She can't join.
Oh, darn.
And Sergi is watching the debate that is happening right now between the candidates for governor down there.
And he said for us to expect a report in an hour when it's done.
And Todd and Kathy will join us as soon as they're through eating. And I don't know what happened to Will in Chicago and Terry.
Hopefully they'll make it back in. Good evening, Waggy.
Howdy, howdy.
And good evening, Sal.
Hello, Bob.
How in the world are you? Thanks for kicking in this evening. It's much appreciated.
Good. You're welcome.
Well, let's. I mean, I've been filibustering for an hour and 15 minutes. Anybody? It's only fair to ask if anybody's got anything that's lighting them up.
Not at the moment. I've been distracted by people asking me how the hell I can get into the Horn chat. I guess their jab is acting up or.
Oh no. Okay. Oh, rats.
That's what Will was having problems with.
Okay.
And
the backdoor address is a little bit too complicated to try to just give out verbally, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I can put it in here, but in the Skype chat, if anybody emails you.
Okay.
But if you've got a problem with a Java, you got to go into your control panel.
Yeah, that's the thing. Java issued an update recently, didn't they?
Yeah, but I didn't have any problems because I'd already set the addresses and it didn't.
Yeah, but see, if you haven't done that, there can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, Carol says, listening right here with you guys. Well, let me. And I'm not picking on anybody. I really am interested in this discussion. Waggy, last night in the chat room, we had a little bit of an exchange over, messaging on things like climate change, and I was really kind of hoping we could expand that discussion.
Sounds good.
Because I am, and I'm not the only one. I've seen it out there in a number of places, people conflicted about this march in Washington. Your thoughts?
Well, I haven't been paying particular attention to that activity, that organization. What's the messaging like?
Well, I mean, it's not so much the messaging. I mean, what I was talking about last night and you and I went back and forth on is this question of how to go about reaching people.
Yeah, the framing and large part and what it is that people care about and that. Yeah, we Americans are really weird on that. You know, we'll have a lot more sympathy for, a doe-eyed squirrel than for especially an adult male human being.
Or even little infant human beings.
Yeah, once they're born.
And you know, that...
Although children often do get a pass on that. I mean, you know, my kid's got cancer is going to get you a heck of a lot more donations than I'm, 47 years old and I got cancer.
Well, that or...
Especially if you're a guy.
Yeah, my American child has cancer is going to get more traction than why don't we try to find another way besides bombing an Iraqi child?
Yeah, oh yeah. Although that's just, plain old nationalism, tribalism, that kind of thing, taking care of our own. That's how I'd expect people to act. But where it gets counterintuitive is where we, stop caring about our own and care more about other things that are just, I guess, less freighted with the pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of nonsense. Because adults in this country, we're all supposed to take care of ourselves. Right. And then take care of.
Yeah, Mr. Gustafson of Camden, South Carolina, in the previous story comes to mind. He thinks South Carolina would do a better job of handling his disability payments when South Carolina would have no way of providing them to him.
Yeah.
But okay, let me ask you this then, Waggy. Do you think it crosses, for lack of a better term, what you referenced, the doe-eyed squirrel factor? Does that cross political boundaries, or is it only lefties, liberals, soft-hearted types who say, "Oh, save the squirrels, please," versus right wingers who say, "F the squirrels. Squirrels is good meat."
I don't know. I think to some degree it does cross political lines because you're talking about the hardcore on either side, and most people are pretty wishy-washy in the middle, and anything that can appeal to emotion without the ick factor coming up, here's a video of a cat being kicked. The right wingers, moderate right wingers, are going to be just as outraged as anyone else. But if it's a homeless person getting kicked, then a lot of those folks would be like, "Well, what's he doing laying on the public street or in the private doorway to a business?"
Yeah,
that whole layer, and I'm not saying that one way or the other is right, because there's no reason with 300 million plus people in the country that you have to have only one message for everyone.
There isn't one message, but I guess the question I'm asking, Waggy, is there an overarching message that has more power than another? And I don't ask that question suggesting that I know the answer. I know what my opinion is on it. But, you know, I'm the guy who has said that maybe if we could put a dead dolphin on top of a blown-up Appalachian mountain, we could get more people to pay attention to MTR.
Yeah, there is a really good point there. I think it depends on the audience, on the people. On, you know, for some people, some things are going to resonate, and for other people, other things are going to resonate. You know, for me, human rights issues go pretty far, but I'm the kind of person who thinks that, you know, our country should sign up to international human rights conventions and extradite people to The Hague.
That's two of us. Actually, that's probably the vast majority, if not the entirety, of the Horn Family Commune congregation. But it's
but a lot of other people are you know, that's anything that even smells like that is just too far off to the left or whatever, and you know, are a lot more sympathetic to, you know, more, I guess, almost less human concerns.
Well, let's see how to put this. How much contact do you have, and I'm not trying to get personal inside your life, Waggy, but how much contact do you have outside of your ideological comfort zone?
I think everyone I know, you know, barring some of the folks in the Horn family, are outside my ideological comfort zone. You know, the people I work with, my family especially, they're a good-hearted conservative Christian, if you can imagine that. I'm not one of the people who has, you know, hundreds and hundreds of friends, so I don't have a whole lot of contact with anyone of any particular persuasion.
The reason that I ask that is because it's almost inescapable around here for me, and maybe for you too in Texas. I because these right wingers will not hesitate to tell you how they feel, or at least that's my experience, because it's how they feel, not how they think. I routinely hear people, and granted, there's been a hell of a lot of advertising and messaging on this. They've beaten this nail. They've countersunk it. Okay, in West by Cole, Virginia. That climate change is just a hoax. Well, how come there's winter? And I think the core of the question that I'm asking is there any messaging, is there any framing that can reach people who think that climate change is a lie from the pits of hell?
Pocketbook.
So how's that going to manifest, Waggy?
I'm not sure, but I'm just kind of free associating, you know, something neutral. I'm surprised drinking water doesn't get folks, because, you know, that's kind of important.
Yeah, access to it. Well, and maybe that's an issue. It's not that, I mean, everybody, yeah, it's important to have clean water. Sure is.
But what you were talking about before about all the damage that mountaintop removal does, you know, you can put a dollar amount on that. That's takings. You know, they took, you know, these are the same people who are going to complain about the property values going down because someone of a different color moved next door. Well, these folks are, you know, driving property values to negative numbers by blowing up the neighboring mountains. There's a pocketbook issue. That could work.
Yeah. Well, where I was kind of going is maybe because you used the drinking water example. They'll say drinking water is important, and then they'll go to their tap, they'll go to their faucet, turn it on, say, "See, there's my drinking water. It's important." And they have not had the experience of, say, people in Toledo or Charleston or Detroit of walking over to that faucet and turning it on and just seeing nothing happen.
Well, I'm thinking also the massive contamination that happened because of coal-related activities in your state there.
Oh, sure.
Or seeing three of your neighbors getting new wells drilled this week.
Yeah, and I can't figure it out. If I poison my neighbor's well, I'm going to jail for a long time.
Yes, you are.
But if a corporation does it in the name of coal, everyone's cool with it. I really don't get it.
Oh, no. I mean, well, the same, this a similar dynamic was at work here in West Virginia earlier this week when an illegal ginseng digging ring was busted. And see, this is one of the outgrowths of that that reality TV series, Appalachian Outlaws. They see these codgers out there getting rich on ginseng that they sell to China, and they think, well, I'm gonna do that too. And they got popped. And the way they're doing it, there's a right way and a wrong way to dig ginseng, and this is probably not the time or the place, but you know, you have to replant the berries when you take the root. Or, you know, you won't have a ginseng patch anymore. And it's really hard to, you know, I don't even know if it can be successfully grown in a domesticated situation. But anyway, they got popped. But as I've noted before, you know, here's two or three people who are going to be put under the jail or fined heavily for illegal ginseng harvesting, which is fine by me. On the other hand, however, if you are Alpha Natural Resources and you've blown away an entire mountain's worth of ginseng, which, by the way, the ginseng harvest in West Virginia rivals coal in value. Coal is $46 a ton. A ton of ginseng in value is measured in millions, if not $1 billion.
Wow.
So how do you square that?
That's what I mean. I don't get it at all. But that certainly can be part of a simple pocketbook kind of message, you know, at least as regards to mountaintop removal, because it is so destructive. And by destructive, that means it's destroying things that have value, even things that have monetary value, as well as, you know, human health and all the rest of those issues that will resonate for other people.
And I think you have to, and at some point in time, you have to figure out how you break through the cognitive dissonance and the yearning for bias confirmation. And in a way, we can sort of back reference what Robert in Morgantown was telling me earlier this evening about Joe Manchin voting the right way for all the wrong reasons on the Get Your War On bill. And if I can make sense of what I just said, Waggy, you're one of these people to whom the words peer reviewed, and the same of course applies to people like Lottie and most of the Horn, if not all, the Horn Family Commune congregation. Peer reviewed has a specific meaning that conveys a certain cachet of legitimacy, does it not?
Yes, indeedy.
Okay.
We understand the concept.
Yeah. So here's a study that's been out for several years now in which Michael Hendricks, Dr. Michael Hendricks, who is now at Indiana University out in Bloomington, analyzed the economic impact of coal in West Virginia. And what he did is he factored in the things that coal doesn't like to talk about. He factored in the externalities. And he found out that for every dollar that coal brings into West Virginia, and we're not just talking about tax dollars, we're talking about economic, you know, the engine of economic, you know, coal keeps the lights on, all that bullshit. For every dollar that it brings in, we in West Virginia pay out five. The study was published and peer-reviewed. Actually, peer-reviewed and then published. And if you ask anybody in the coal industry about it, they say, well, we disagree with the findings of that study. And if you ask some rank and file type, well, what about the? Well, that's just another one of them liberal lies. And I'm not trying to mock people here, but that is the reality, and I suspect it's a broader reality. It's not just West Virginia. I'm just talking about a West Virginia specific example. But if we are going to deal with climate change, we have got to reach these folks somehow, some way. Because, okay, go ahead, Wag.
I was going to say the alternative is to have it regulated at a federal level, and West Virginia votes nay, and everyone else votes yay. Not to pick on West Virginia. I mean, you know, the complete deniers in that, if they're not in power, they're just going to have to get outvoted.
No,
I mean, that's another way to go around it before you get 100% buy-in. That's how a lot of stuff in this country has happened.
And if it was just
finally,
and if it
people
was,
turned around.
But if it was, and if it was just West Virginia, I think we'd have a chance.
Yeah, and there's a whole block against it right now, but that's changing. Texas is going blue. It's just a matter of when. We're hoping for, you know, starting this year, but it could be another 10 years down the road. But it's going to happen, and that's a big chunk there.
Well, I'm not much interested in playing profit, but where that issue is concerned, I'm specific. Wow, this is political nerdism, you know, at the graduate level. We're trying to get, you know, you try to get people to focus on the 2014 elections, and yet we want to talk about the 2016 presidential cycle. Well, there will be another presidential cycle in 2020. There will be off-year midterm elections in 2018. You know the election that I'm really fascinated with, Waggy?
What's that one?
2022. I'll be 59 years old. I'm fascinated with the election of 2022 because that is going to be the first congressional midterm election or first congressional elections of any sort after the analysis and collation of the data from the 2020 census.
I see where you're going. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about Texas going blue. If things don't change in 2020 in places where the demographics have really, really significantly shifted, like Texas, they ain't going to change.
And redistricting.
Right. Yeah. And what will be interesting is to watch the methods by which the right wing, which cannot win with high voter participation, tries to stifle that participation and tries to continue with the gerrymandering shenanigans with which it had such success in 2010. One of the things you'll see, let's write down the date and the time and everything. One of the things you'll see in 2020 is it will be a ramped up version of what we experienced in 2010.
They're going to want fingerprints.
Oh, no. But in 2010, you had a right-wing effort to get people to think that the census takers were going to, they were going to make you be a communist or something. And I remember in the year 2000, Flush Flimbaugh screaming about the use of statistical modeling by the census.
Yep, I remember that too.
It's going to get, oh, it's 2020.
It's going to get, weird. Yeah, I'm going to get interesting.
So there's a lot to watch there. I don't, who's got audio in the background?
I think it's Terry. Antonol.
Hey, Antonol.
Turn the volume down.
Yes. There we go.
There we go.
Thank you.
I don't think that was even us.
No, I think it was Tom Hartman replay or something.
It's a big picture roundtable.
Oh, that sounds fun. Who is that?
Tom Hartman.
Oh, Big Picture Roundtable. Okay, yeah. I've never heard of that before, so. since we do know that you're connected, jump right in if you want.
I guess not.
I'm trying to verify myself.
Are you sure you're you now? Well, Sparky, a minute ago you mentioned neighbors getting three wells.
Your sound went sideways, Bob.
I'll be damned. So far so good, at least on this end, is it? Anything?
Better.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's definitely better.
You said you had three neighbors getting wells drilled, Sparky.
Right.
Yeah. Elaborate on that a little bit, please.
All I know is wherever their pump was set, whatever, I mean, their depth of their well, my neighbor, just on down, he's one house over. I mean, I got a neighbor between them. They just finished his well today, and then they went down the street to start digging another one. And they were on the corner digging one about three houses down earlier this week. So it's wherever they're the one neighbor that just had the well finished, he was drawing at 40 feet. So I must be deeper than that because I still got a good stream of water. And it probably depends on the fissures and fractures or whatever your well head is into, but it's scary.
How expensive a proposition is that out there, drilling a new well?
About $10,000.
Jesus. And that's just to get, if it's anything like it is around here, that's to get to the first vein. If you hit a vein of water and you decide it's icky and you want to go deeper, you pay by the foot after that, don't you?
I'm not sure. I've just heard rumors from people.
It's got to be scary. It's got to be scary to people out there.
Well, we're all basically sitting on top of the same water, and then I got the ranch right behind me. He's flooding his field. I don't know how deep his well is. Next time I talk to him, I'll ask. But and then we got all the agriculture down the valley here. I mean, walnuts, almonds, pistachios, peaches, plums. They make prunes into. I mean, they got all kinds of tree agriculture. And then if you go further down, I mean, it's the valley, they have their rice and probably GMO corn. But the canals that run down from here that farmers get the water out of, I mean, they're getting cut back by the Bureau of Reclamation. It controls Shasta Dam, where all the water was stored, or Oroville Dam. And then there's a lake that they always show near Sacramento. It's called Folsom, and it's practically bone dry. And then we have the forest fires, or little fires that burn up 100 homes in like an hour. That was so sad. That was a terrible thing. Those people didn't even have time to get anything out. It was just, get out now. My stepson has a friend that lives there in Weed and works at the elementary school. And the playground there burned up, but his car was parked near the playground. It got charred. Peeled the paint
off.
And it just
happened.
I mean, it was just boom. It was like a firestorm when it lit up. It is so freaking windy up there. And everything was so dry, everything just exploded.
And that can happen from a cigarette butt flicked out a window, right?
Yeah, but it was supposedly out in the meadow or something where it started. I mean, near that little subdivision. It was near the Roseburg Lumber Mill, somewhere out in there. I've worked up in Weed before, but I'm not exactly too sure. I mean, I've seen it on the Google Earth map, approximately where it started. But it just ripped through that town within a couple hours.
And
people didn't have a time. I mean, one guy was on the news. He got out, and all he's got is his shirt on his back. The whole house burnt to the ground.
And does that area, I guess, now is deemed fire-prone. Of course, most of California is at this point, I guess. Does homeowners insurance cover on that kind of thing, or do they have an army of lawyers who say, we don't pay?
Probably both.
They can come out, and if you don't do fire breaks around here, it depends on where you live. Where I live here in the subdivision with the ranch behind us and everything, and, you know, all the houses around me, I'm pretty safe from any kind of fire. I've seen the hillsides near here burn up before because they're just dry as bone, and then they're oak trees and stuff. But those pine trees that they got, like, up there, I mean, once you heat that up and the sap starts coming out, they just explode.
Yeah, they're just rooted torches, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've seen that picture online, but the picture of this one tree just burning all the way up it.
Yeah.
And somebody circled it. They said, the face of the devil is in that fire.
Yes. only if it's the face of Senator Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, as far as I'm concerned. Because he's as close, I mean... Okay, so this is a perfect example, Sparky, of a non-Appalachian version of the question I was asking.
Mm-hmm.
And that is this. Now, Weed, California is up there smack dab in the middle of Free State of Jefferson Country, right?
Yes.
So,
but the county didn't vote to. When they had the primary election, it was on the ballot, and Siskiyou County turned it down.
Well, I get that, but they got it on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And
my county was the only one to approve it.
Yeah, but I mean, work with me here. There were some of those, you know, secessionist birther, deather, tenther, bagger, booger eaters in fairly ready supply up that way, right?
Yeah, in Siskiyou County. It's where it really took birth. Up in Yreka is where it really started, and then there's some in...
And these are libertarians. These are libertarians who think that fire departments are socialism. Right?
Well, the main thing with the state of Jefferson now is that they don't have a voice in the capital at Sacramento. Their main complaint is, we don't get anything up here. It's all because there's more people in Southern California. So all the Southern California Democrats in the Bay Area, I mean, they rule the roost. You can't get anything done to help the people up here, they think.
Right, but when you say...
When they're rebuilding I-5 all the way through to the Oregon border, I think they're doing something for us.
Well, there's that, and there's the fact that, you know, when you say, we don't have a voice in Sacramento, well, that's like saying that you're electing representatives and sending them to Sacramento and the legislature's refusing to seat them, and that is certainly not the case. What they are saying, though, is, and, you know, November's coming... What they're saying is our representatives in Sacramento are ineffective. I mean, isn't that the upshot?
Correct, because they're Republicans.
There we go. They're sending Republicans to a Democratic majority.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you suppose they might have a little more responsive government if they sent Democrats to a Democratic majority? I mean, call me crazy.
Yeah, they might get a little bit more done. I mean, the last Democrat representative that I know of from up here, back in the 70s, got stuff done. They even named buildings into fairground in her name.
Well, the reason I ask is that, like I said, it's a good non-Appalachian example of how do you break through. I mean, for instance, could you walk up to one of those Free State of Jefferson types, say, in Weed, and ask them, still denying climate change? Haven't had rain here in a while now, have we?
Well, all you got to do is tell them, turn around, look at that mountain. There ain't a Glacier One left on it. There was a picture the other day of looking out through the church that burnt down at Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
And it wasn't one glacier on it. From Weed. And you could, a few years ago, you could see glaciers.
Yeah, but that's just God's will, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, I can walk out my backyard and see Mount Lassen. All my life, there has been this one glacier that's come down the side of Mount Lassen. We could always see it every year after year. It's gone.
And so, you know, I return to my thesis. But Waggy, jump in. I was reading the chat room there, and
oh yeah, I had the privilege of flying over Mount Kilimanjaro last month and had a gorgeous view out the airplane window. It was unusually clear, and the thing looked practically naked.
No glaciers at all?
No, there was some streaks of white, but it did not look at all like any of the pictures I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was gorgeous, but I was surprised when I saw it. I was like, wow, look at that mountain. And then the captain came out and said, that's Mount Kilimanjaro, and an unusual clear view of it. It is? Where's the
snows of?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, well, you know, Ernest Hemingway made that famous. There's a short story. It's a brilliant short story. The Snows of Kilimanjaro.
Most of the stuff that he wrote is brilliant.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't snap a pic because that particular flight had no electronic devices the whole time. Unfortunately.
Hey, Bob, do you want to make a comment on our friend that's seeing big mountains for the first time?
Yeah. Ferg is traveling right now on his first great adventure. Even as we speak, he is probably somewhere getting ready to cross into the Pacific time zone, and has gone from North Dakota, and for the last 2 days he's been crossing Montana. And before he left, I said, son, you're an Appalachian. These are the mountains you know. Because, and just as sort of background to all this, a couple of years ago we were down toward Knoxville for I was speaking at the University of Tennessee. And on the way back, I took a little detour to take him toward the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And the Great Smoky Mountains National Park dwarf the mountains we have here. I mean, you're driving on this four-lane highway, and all of a sudden there's this wall up into the sky of mountains, and it's the Smoky. And I remember back then that Ferg was like, damn, Dad, those are huge! Yeah, they're pretty big, son. But I remember saying at the time, I said to him, one of these days, boy, you're going to see some mountains that are going to blow your freaking mind. Well, that time is now. He is beginning to see the Rockies. And let me check my text messages here real quick. Looking. Well, can't find it right now. But I've gotten a couple of phone calls. Dad, you were right. I'm beginning to see mountains, and these are the low ones, and they block out the sky. Yeah. But you know, because he's my son, and because he's got a few years of horn food porn under his belt, the other thing I got a call was, I actually got a call over this afternoon. Dad, I just ate the best beef I've ever tasted in my life. I just had the best hamburger I've ever had in my life. It was fresh, Dad. It was organic and hormone-free, and it doesn't taste like anything we get back home.
Was it Black Angus?
I didn't ask.
Y'all need to try Zebu.
I'm certainly open to the experience, Waggy. So they're headed for California. They'll be going into Washington State, down through Oregon, and
oh, he's gonna get to see the Cascades then.
Yes, he is.
And remind him, those aren't just mountains; they're volcanoes.
He's already noted that. Dad, I think a lot of these are volcanoes, or at least were.
Well, he'd be able to see it when he eventually gets to see Mount Shasta. He's going to have a hellacious view of it.
And by the way, a note just came in from Marty with a question mark. Mount Shasta's dry? You want to field that one, Sparky?
There's no glaciers on the sides that I could see. There's one side. When I went up to the mountains 2 weeks ago, where I went, you can see the eastern side of the mountain, and there was still glaciers on it. But where Ferg's gonna, Weed is on the northwestern side, and then I see the south side, and drive up to Redding, there's just one teeny tiny little glacier right at the top that you could see a couple of weeks ago, and it may be gone by now.
As compared to what did it look like in, say, decades past?
It'd be white almost all summer.
Now, will it, with the coming of cold weather, will it whiten up again?
Yeah, but the glaciers aren't going to form again unless you have the glaciers take years to make. Because a glacier is snowpack year after year on top of each other, and it melts on the surface, and the water goes through it, and it turns the rest of what's below it into ice, and it refreezes at night. And it builds up that way. And it's in the crevices and ravines of the mountain.
Well, Marty also pointed out, Sparky, he said, a fire set in Placer County turns out to have been set deliberately. And he says, Sparky's correct about Folsom Lake. I saw it from a nearby neighborhood. Man, I have never seen it so low.
Hey, y'all.
Hey,
oh,
Sergi.
Here we go. You ready to give your report, Sergi?
Yes, sir, I am. So, for those of y'all not aware, hold on. Okay, sorry about that. I'm back. So for those of y'all who didn't know, weren't aware, the last hour was the Texas governor debate here between Greg Abbott and Wendy Davis, and Wendy pulled no punches. She tore him to shreds, and it was awesome.
Did she beat him like a bar of meal?
Here's the thing. Wendy Davis had it in her mind that she's running against Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott had it in his mind that he's running against President Obama.
Barack Obama, yeah.
He mentioned... He addressed Barack Obama more times than he did Wendy Davis. He literally, I counted, he addressed Barack Obama or the federal government more than he did Wendy Davis. So, I've been monitoring the hashtag on Twitter, which is RGV, V as in Victor, for Rio Grande Valley debates, because that's where it was. It was in Edinburgh. And, a lot of people are wondering, it's like, I didn't know Barack Obama was running for governor of Texas.
but that's a deliberate political strategy, Sergi, and there's a whole bunch of people out there that's going to resonate with. We gotta have a man who'll stand up for that Kenyan Muslim usurper, or else Texas will turn socialist.
I mean, I did definitely understand. He's trying to tune in to that. Segment of the Texas population that's afflicted with Obama derangement syndrome. But, the simple fact of the matter is that he not only failed to address he failed to address the cuts he made to education. Wendy made sure to mention that multiple times. Wendy made sure to mention Ted Nugent. Abbott did not answer that.
As in his buddy Ted Nugent?
His buddy Ted Nugent, and she didn't just say Ted Nugent, okay? She made sure to mention his, the fact that Ted Ted's a predator and, racist and sexist and homophobic stuff. She made sure to bring that up as well. The simple fact of the matter is that Abbott thought he was running against Barack Obama. Wendy Davis brought up Abbott's record, which he did not address. And there was one point where the moderator actually tried to, it was a very piss poor moderator. Let me just say that right now. He cut Wendy off 5, 6, 7 times, didn't do the same to Abbott. And I'm sure people noticed that too.
That's sexism. That's just plain sexism, Sergi. That is documentable male behavior.
Oh yeah, and there was one female moderator, but he was the head moderator or whatever. But I mean, I've been monitoring on Twitter. People have noticed that. They have noticed that Abbott failed to address his record. They noticed the sexist behavior of the moderator and Abbott towards Wendy Davis, And Wendy also hit him hard on not accepting the Medicaid expansion. And the awesome part was anyone who knows much about Texas politics knows that Texas loves to, these Republicans here in Texas love to bash California. Well, Wendy turned that on Abbott by, framing it in a way that he forfeited our Medicaid money to California, and concluded by saying Greg Abbott is California's best friend in Texas. And I have news for you, Mr. Abbott. California already has a governor. They don't need to. And that was the best moment of the debate.
Oh, that's a body blow, without a doubt.
That is the clip that is going to be played. That is the clip that is going to be played.
Let me ask you, Sergi, will there? We had the one debate debacle, and now we've had this one. Will there be post debate polling?
There's there. there will be post-debate polling, you know, and we're going to be seeing about that. I'm going to be monitoring the news outlets around the state this, you know, this evening and tonight. As far as the next debate, it's going to be the one on the 30th, which is going to be this one was broadcast statewide, like it was on Greg Abbott, even though he tried to get out of, you know, being whipped by Wendy statewide. Yeah, I mean, this was simulcast on dozens of TV stations and radio stations around the state. So Texans were listening this evening, and they heard Wendy get, because Greg's words could be summed up in that he was trying to tap into Obama derangement syndrome sufferers. He basically focused on red meat to the base, which, I mean, considering the fact that we're activating Democrats and independents here, we're not just focused on the base. I guess we'll see if it's enough, okay, for him to fire up the base while alienating everybody else, including the libertarian-minded Republicans. Because the libertarian-minded Republicans, there was actually a pretty good firestorm on Twitter for this. His hawkish policies, Greg Abbott's hawkish policy proposals on like security and policing and such, they turned off the libertarian base in the Republican Party.
Well, let me ask you, Sergi, how does Greg Abbott feel about legalizing dope?
That wasn't even brought up.
Well, I mean, because that's what matters to libertarians. Are we going to be able to smoke dope? Because libertarians are just Republicans who want to smoke dope.
I'm talking about like real like bona fide libertarians who don't want the police breathing down their neck every step of the way, you know. And Greg Abbott's hawkish policies, you know, I mean, the way he was talking is like, let's turn Texas into a police state because illegals and because, I kid you not, ISIS. He brought up ISIS. Yeah, because ISIS is so going to focus on Texas. It's not like there's any other big cities anywhere in the United States they want to get first. Nope, they're coming straight to Texas.
and you know what? They're gonna blow right past what? Fort Bliss? That's the part that blows my mind.
Yeah, and all
I mean, because Fort Bliss is down there toward the Mexican border, right?
Yes, it is.
And so those 35,000 ISIL fighters.
We have so many people on.
So those 35,000 ISIL fighters that are going to come boiling across the border in Midland County, Texas, according to the sheriff down there. And they are going to, according to that fainting hero Lindsey Graham, kill all of, get us all killed. That was the phrase. They're gonna the entire base at Fort Bliss is just gonna go, I wonder who those are. I love it.
Yeah, and I mean by this point we have so many agents on the border that we can put one every 250 feet. They're not getting through. They could easily use semaphore. That's just how many... Oh, Lord. Lost the connection.
No, you're right here.
Am I back?
You've never left.
Okay, my connection was saying. But anyway, yeah, I mean, we have so many people on the border, they could easily use semaphore. One, I mean, they're not, ISIS is not in any concern. And so, you know, all this, like, even though it's hard to believe, here in Texas, we have a very strong contingent of quote-unquote soft Republicans. That's how Wendy Davis first won her Senate. That's how she got elected to the Texas Senate. She's in a Republican-leaning district, but she still managed to blow Dr. Mark Shelton out of the water by 3,000-plus votes last time. There's a lot of soft Republicans, mostly women, surprise, who are not going. They're either not going to vote for Abbott and stay it. Why am I hearing myself?
Roger just chimed in.
Yeah, Roger, you need to mute.
Hey, can you mute Roger, please? Welcome aboard, by the way. And?
Oh, Roger.
Stand by, Sergi.
I think we're good now.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, there's a lot of so-called soft Republicans here that, I mean, they're the same reason Ann Richards got elected when she did. And so the same thing that happened for her Senate seat, I can see happening across the state, because these are Republicans. They're mostly women, like I said. They are Republicans, but they don't give a flying rat's ass about ISIS. They don't care about them illegals. They don't care about...
Well, no, those soft Republicans, them illegals, are mowing their yards.
Barack Obama. They care about...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the issues that matter to them are, number one, safety. Wendy covered that. Talked about the West explosion. We need to be knowing where these chemicals that can blow sky high and wipe off entire towns off the map are. She brought that up, covered that base. B, education. She made sure to push education, okay, which that's the number one thing because most of these South Republicans have kids. Then three, okay, she also brought up economic development, the three bases right there. And so... with that, I think that just like with their Senate run, locking in those swayable Republicans, which is who she needs to win. And I do think that, you know, I'm going to be looking at this, I'm going to be doing the same thing with this next debate coming up on the 30th. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm hoping she continues to go strongly.
Yeah.
And, you know, just I'm hoping that she continues to, what are you laughing at? Anyway.
I think that's Terry that's laughing. He must now have his mic mute.
Well, they're laughing. They're laughing at the chat room. The chat room's misbehaving right now. Somebody just put up several lines of Baba the Hutt in the chat room.
Again?
Yes, they're doing that again. Don't encourage them.
It's Devin.
Well, either mute. I need to... finished, Terry. I don't want to take up a bunch of time on the show. But anyway, like I was saying, you know, Abbott tonight succeeded in turning off independents, turning off these salt Republicans, and turning off pretty much everybody that isn't a Tea Party. And so even here in Texas, you know, if you're running against a strong Democrat, the Tea Party is not, and Wendy's definitely a strong Democrat. Ted Cruz got elected because Sadler was a lily liver. You know, that's how Cruz got in there. But when you're running against a strong Democrat.
Yeah, it's a different story. Well, did you see any response? Did she score points, do you think, with the reference to West? Sergi?
Shooting a test in the break.
We lost him, Bob.
Oh, darn. Hopefully he'll be back. Yeah, you're good, Roger.
Thank you.
Very good. No, I asked him the question about West Texas because, you know, West Texas is the airborne toxins equivalent of the Freedom disaster in Charleston. I mean, they really should be talked about in the same breath. Sergi, what I had asked earlier is, do you think she scored points with the reference to West?
Yes, she did, because people realize, I wish she had gotten around to mentioning Abbott's drive around comment. But she did make sure to mention that he does not want these people, you know, the average person to know what's in these plants. And she also made sure to bring up the Koch brothers, you know, because, I mean, the Kochs are tied to these fertilizer plants here. They own them.
Did the Kochs have a direct tie to the one in West? Do we know that?
Don't know about the one in West, but there's plenty of other plants though that do. They pose just as much of a potential explosive risk as West. And Greg Abbott's hiding, helping them hide what's there, you know, and saying, well, we don't want terrorists to know where the chemicals are, so we're not going to let you know either. That was his excuse. Literally, was terrorists. And, you know, Wendy Davis made sure to mention, you know, these fertilizer plants could blow sky high.
Yeah, it didn't take any terrorists to blow up the one in West.
Yeah, they just managed to blow themselves off. They're terrorizing themselves, like old Saddam.
And you know, I've noted Sergi from time to time my own geographic ignorance of Texas. It's a huge state. I'll be the first to admit. But I do, you know, when I think Texas, I tend to think Dallas, Fort Worth, you know, that highway down to Waco, down to Austin, out towards San Antonio, on to El Paso. You know, Amarillo and Houston don't exist for me, and that's my ignorance. But one of the things that comes to mind is if you're going to talk about the chemical plants, I wonder if down in more of that bayou coastal area around Houston, I gotta imagine that y'all have some chemical tanks that are probably holding some really obnoxious shit next to some streams, you know, kind of like Charleston, only probably lots more dangerous and lots bigger.
Yeah, that area is really bad. I knew an emergency room nurse who worked there for a few months, and people there are just, they got all kinds of stuff. Just funny, kind of like the folks there in West Virginia.
Well, yeah,
a lot like it.
Well, there's a kinship. They're both deeply deeply exploited regions.
And oil keeps them quiet.
Yeah, from about the Alabama River and Mobile Bay west to Houston. That whole area has been toxified by the chemical and oil industries. I wonder if that's on her radar, Sergi.
You dropped again, Bob.
Oh, darn.
But I have a thought. Why can't we tie climate change into terrorism?
Well, I was kind of alluding to that earlier, Sparky. There's a climate change element to us getting our war on again. We don't go to the Middle East because we're concerned about democracy in the Middle East. Can we please give up that stupidity? We're concerned about the Middle East because the Middle East has our oil under its sand.
Or the oil company's oil.
Yeah, and it's not just oil, Bob. As long as people X are fighting people Y, people X and Y will need to buy large-scale weaponry.
Absolutely, Sal. Oh, and hey, I want to just throw something out there because we had talked about this in a previous Friday on the Front Porch conversation. I'm not trying to embarrass or anything, but I want to publicly thank you, Sal, for supporting the 8 campaign.
Oh, you're welcome, Bob.
That means a great, 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 great deal. You're a friend of this program, and when I called Bo and told him to, you know, keep an eye on the mailbox, he was thrilled.
That's awesome. That's
absolutely awesome. Thrilled.
Yeah, I actually put that letter in the mail today, this morning. And so the A campaign will get an interesting letter in the mail from me. And it will include the last solicitation I received from the Sierra Club.
Okay.
Just as evidence. Just as evidence that I'm fulfilling my obligation.
Beautiful. Beautiful, Sal. Thank you. But, no, you're right. I mean, we Calvin Coolidge said the business of America is business, and what that means in 2014 is that the business of America is the business of selling guns to both sides in any given fight. I don't know how many of you are aware, but we let Petro Poroshenko address a joint session of Congress before they bugged out on vacation.
And he had begging for your money, my money, our money, for the fascist side of the fight in that dispute with Russia. That was not inspiring.
Nope.
And of course, we agreed to send butter, but not guns. Oh, and by the way, I saw a note from M. Brandt in the chat room a little while back I wanted to reference, in which he pointed out that, Lake Folsom is bone dry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd kind of wanted to raise a secondary issue, because I think there's a certain interconnection of all these things. Let me also note that we remain $45 away from meeting Robert in Australia's Up Over Down Under 20th of the Month challenge. It would be awfully nice if we could meet that before, say, 9 p.m. Eastern time, because, you know, when folks do put challenges out there, they're walking the walk and talking the talk. And so whether it's 9 people at $5 or 5 people at $9 or somebody at $45, it would be awfully nice to be able to close the program noting that we had met Robert in Australia's monthly 20th of the month Up Over Down Under challenge. But I wanted to go back to something, because it just kind of, when Sparky, when you started talking about bone dry reservoirs, because, you know, these are man-made lakes, right? I mean, Lake Folsom.
Most of them, yes.
Yeah, Lake Folsom is a lake. It's a reservoir behind a dam.
Yeah, it's the American River flow that comes down out of the hills, out of the Sierras.
And it's fed by snowmelt, correct?
Correct.
Well, and I'm not trying to pick on a sustainable industry here in West Virginia. That is not my point. But I want to offer a comparison. Now, if we have a brilliant little tourism industry that brings in millions of dollars to this area, that's mostly concentrated in the hands of the people who own the tourism companies, but some of it does dwindle down into the funky little community that we have here, and it provides a few jobs. And for most of the year, beginning about March or April, mostly April, and then it really picks up when warm weather comes, there is a burgeoning, I mean, they stay busy.
Whitewater rafting.
Whitewater rafting, ecotourism, rock climbing. And during that time period, you know, March, April, May, June, July, August, it's whitewater rafting of the New River, which is just fun. It goes through the New River Gorge. It's beautiful. Goes under the New River Gorge Bridge. It's magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good river. It's a river that you can comfortably raft with, say, your kids. I mean, Dan Quayle, for God's sakes, the man who said potato has an E, successfully rafted the New River. Now, where I am right now sits between the New River and the Gauley River. The Gauley River is a dammed river, where the New River is not. And what's known as Gauley season around here happens in September and all the way up to the third Saturday in October, and culminates with Bridge Day, when 100,000 people walk out onto a bridge, a single arch bridge that's 876 feet in the air, and watch people who have taken leave of their senses jump off of it with a parachute.
Mm-hmm.
Gauley season is created by releases from Summersville Dam. And Summersville Dam is an earthen dam of the Gauley River that, you know, by the end of summer has filled up to this beautiful, beautiful lake. And every day, in order to create Gauley rafting season, they release water from the dam down the river to create these monster, monster, monster rapids.
And they have no hydroelectric power plant.
No.
Talk about stupid.
Well, you can't have a hydroelectric power plant there. Coal keeps the lights on, Sparky.
Well, up here, we use water, same water, 4 or 5 times to generate electricity.
But what I'm asking here is, okay, you're in most instances where you have dams on rivers, if hydroelectric power generation is not the first consideration, then the first consideration is flood control. And the Gauley River,
irrigation.
Yeah, well, but we don't have to irrigate here. We're a rainforest. The Gauley River extends a good ways back up from Summersville. Actually, just a little piece of trivia because it's fun. The dam, I've been told, was originally built at a community called GAD, G-A-D. But it is called Summersville Dam, even though it's not in Summersville. It's called Summersville Dam because the pious, God-fearing, Bible-believing, upstanding people here didn't think it would be a good idea to have GAD Dam. Tough crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
GAD.
I got it.
Okay, thank you.
GADs.
Thank you.
Todd and Kathy are here.
Thank you, Kath. I was losing faith in humanity there for a minute. I thought we'd burned up all our dirty mind cells.
No.
Beautiful.
How you guys?
Good, Kath. How about you?
Hanging in. Doing fine.
So, just to wrap up real quick, I don't know. I guess the releases from the dam are a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, because by the time they're done releasing, Summersville Lake will be a puddle. And I could be entirely wrong. It just occurred to me to ask this question. With water being precious and becoming scarcer and scarcer, is that a good idea? I will rely upon the scientific types to tell me whether or not that's release on that scale is a necessity of hydrogeologic management, keeping pressure off the dam, whatever. But I find it interesting that you've got Lake Folsom up there that is basically now a ditch, and we're supporting but you know what, it's renewable and sustainable tourism.
But my question would be, what is it doing for the fish in the river system?
Roger, you know the story of the Red Bluff Diversion Dam?
I'm well aware of all kinds of diversions, and the fact that Trinity Lake is now releasing to try to prevent the fish kill of 2002 on the Lower Klamath.
Are you in a windstorm?
No, I'm just sitting out in the backyard drinking beer and listening to the program with my headphones.
Well,
I'm in the garage now.
I don't necessarily know what the impact is on the fish population, Roger. And wait a minute.
Let me one on one with Roger. How is Trinity Lake affecting the Klamath?
Because Trinity Lake is a dam on the Trinity River, and the Trinity River is the largest tributary of the Klamath River. And when the water warms up, there's a bacteria that gets into the fish, and they all die off. Back in 2002, there were like 600,000 salmon that died, or 60,000 salmon that died in the Lower Trinity because the water was too warm, because it was all being sent over the hill from Trinity Lake to Lewiston Lake to Whiskeytown
Lake
to
Spring Creek Powerhouse to Keswick Dam. That's why. Yeah. That's where we make the power like five times with the same water.
Well, the car powerhouse.
Yeah.
Into Whiskeytown.
Right.
And that comes out of Trinity Lake.
I know it does.
Which is diversion from the Trinity River, which is the largest tributary to the Klamath River.
But where do the Klamath and the Trinity run together over there somewhere in Humboldt County, right?
Well, they tie together at Wichipeck, which is the join.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Wichipeck, yeah.
Okay, and the Klamath comes down through Happy Camp and all that.
Right.
And at Wichipeck, the Trinity and the Klamath come together and flow down to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the Klamath has dams on it. Now the Trinity has dams on it. Back in the 50s, 60s, when they put them in, the agreement was if it screws up the fish population, the fish get the water. It's never happened.
Well,
the valley gets the water.
Well, the fish have had a say in a bunch. Do you remember back in the 90s when they put the temperature control device on Shasta Dam?
No. I don't, because Shasta's not part of the Klamath.
Well, anyway, they put this device on there so they could get the cold water from the bottom of the lake because of the fish. And the Red Bluff Diversion Dam that was there to feed the Tama Calusa Canal for irrigation, when they first built the Red Bluff Diversion Dam, they put in a salmon spawning channel next to the dam. Well, that failed. And then they tried this one pump system. They put this one pump system in by the dam in the 90s, and it didn't work. So now they built this new diversion thing there with these different pumps, and they're going to tear out the diversion dam. It's been there since the early 60s. I mean, it was just destroyed the economy. The tourism economy that we had with the Sacramento River here in town, because we used to have the boat drags, and you used to be able to launch your boat at a Red Bluff City Park and go up the river and water ski and do everything. You can't do that now.
By Willow Creek, they used to have the hydroplane races, and they can't run them anymore because there's no water.
Yeah, well, they're going to spend a couple million dollars putting a new boat ramp in at the city park for this little. Don't even look like the river we've all known in all these years. It's just a trickle. I mean, right in front of the Red Bluff City Park used to be water all the way up to the park. Well, but now there's a big old gravel bar right there in the middle of town underneath the bridge. And then the East Sand Slough is gone. I mean, you used to be able to water ski in that. And it's just growing up with plant life. And it burned a couple of years ago. It knocked out my internet connection because the line went through an area there that caught on fire.
Well, I was out at a friend's house today near Blue Lake. If anybody that wants to look it up on Google Maps, whatever, Blue Lake, California.
I know where it is.
The North Fork of the Mad River flows right next to his property. And there was a picnic table there. And I went out and I looked over to the bank of the river, and there's no water in it. It's the first time in 10 years there's never been any water flowing past his house. We're dry. There's no doubt about that. And yet they're still sucking water off to all kinds of godforsaken crap.
And so, Roger, the question arises, you weren't here when I was putting it earlier in the program, maybe you heard it. The question then arises, this could not be any more obviously driven by climate change. Unless smoke signals were going up from the goddamn forest fire spelling out climate change is real, Dorothy.
I agree.
So how do you reach the free state of Jefferson types?
Yeah. You can't.
You just have to act without them.
The free state of Jefferson types are totally unreachable. You cannot talk to them about science. You can't talk about them to a logic, anything else. They are so embedded in racial hatred, and they've been so brainwashed by ABC, CBS, Fox News, and all the rest of that, that any science logic stuff will not get to them. They are a bunch of ignorant AHs.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
I've given up.
They didn't have the state of Jefferson on the ballot in Humboldt County, did they?
No. It's not on the ballot in Humboldt County.
Well, didn't they get it in Del Norte County?
They might have got it in Del Norte. I'm not sure.
Oh.
Hi there.
But we were Tama County was the only one to vote for it, which makes me ashamed of where I live.
Yeah. I wanted to say hello.
Hey, good evening, Larry. Hello, Larry. Happy birthday.
No, it was not on the ballot here. Hi, Larry.
Hi there.
Happy birthday, Larry.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. I wanted to ask a question, a couple of things. There's a student in one of my classes taking ethnic studies, and he was from McKinleyville, and he was saying that they still are very racist in McKinleyville, that you can't be, you know, that can't be in a place after 6 o'clock or something. And, you know, I know Roger is pretty open-minded, and he's from around that area, so, you know, I can't figure, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. That's number one. And then number two, I'm starting to read a book, The Nonviolence Handbook by Michael Nagler. And what he says is that quantum mechanics has taught us that we're a lot closer to one another and we're all part of one another. And that we all, you know, we all basically are related to one another. So therefore our attitudes of separation and needing to have war against one another, or needing to see ourselves as separated from one another, that kind of worldview is changing things. And I always believe that. But right now I'm seeing things in terms of, you know, black and white, and I'm feeling separated. So how do you reconcile a quantum mechanics view of the world where we all feel like we're you know, more alike than we are apart, when we still have these political divisions and you know, epistemological or ontological or worldview differences between that can't be overcome? And he's talking about Gandhi. He's talking about the quantum mechanics view of the universe.
Can I take this one?
Please do. Would you?
It is the difference, Larry, between people who are driven by reality and science versus people who are driven by faith and belief. Racism and bigotry and prejudice is not science. It is not reality. It is not factual. It is driven by, at best, you know, the amygdala, the lizard brain. It is not driven by the higher intellectual functions of Homo sapiens sapiens. And I think that gets to it pretty quickly.
Okay.
Hey, let me run back just for a minute and acknowledge incoming help. Thank you to Philip and Michael and Robert. We are now only $20 away from meeting Robert in Australia's 20th of the month up over down under challenge. Robert sent a note along a couple minutes ago and says, while the challenge is $100 U.S., thanks to the falling Aussie dollar, it'll cost me $112. So come on, folks, chip in, but only if you can. 45 people at a dollar each would do it. And now it's just 20. And taken together with the entire deficit we had closing out the week, $20 meets the challenge. $55 fills in the hole, and $75 gets you the Ozark Yummy Gift Basket, and $100 gets you the your choice of Northern California pistachios or smoky ghost pepper cheese. So one and all, hopefully that'll happen. $20 at a minimum, $55 to finish out the week, and the yummy gift baskets, yummy parcels in the mail is what it boils down to. There will be no baskets involved. Are out there on the table too, and it would be really, and it's a really lovely premium for anybody who wants to do that.
Hey, Bob.
Wait, please, Sparky. I just want to share this before we go off on another, you know, down the road again. Philip, in addition to helping out this evening, sent along a note, and he said, "I've been to West Texas. It's a small Texas town renowned for its Czech bakeries and culture. I too have been there on my one and only trip to Texas, and I tried the Czech pastries, and oh my God!" And they had this jalapeno spread. Oh, that was magnificent. When I heard it blew up, Philip says, I was not surprised because of the lack of adequate zoning laws and regulation in Texas. If Sergi returns, ask him about cancer rates in the Orange Triangle and the conflagration in Texas City a couple of decades ago. By the way, as an aside, my 13-year-old grandson, a native Texan, visited us this summer. My daughter wanted him to hear alternative views to those with which he is inundated there. I was surprised by the liberalness, liberal with a small L, of his views and the insightful opinions he had. I'd claim it was genetic, except that his mother is my stepdaughter, so I have to assume it's contagious. When I speak with him or listen to Sergi, Texas Betsy, and other Texans on the horn, I think that Molly Ivins's legacy continues, and Texas may one day be the state that was proud to elect Ralph Yarborough and Barbara Jordan. May the compassion and intelligence of Texas's citizens soon match its scenic beauty and great cuisine. I know of no other state like Texas, and when friends ask me what it was like to live there for a decade, I respond that it's the Quebec of the United States. For that matter, New Orleans is more a Caribbean than a North American city. Also, thanks for the front porch, Philip says. It's wonderful to hear other horn listeners conversing about the news and issues of the day. Y'all be well. Signed, Philip. Thank you, Philip. Thank you so very much for all you do to help us keep going. And thank you for those observations, because I love the idea that the horn contingent is manifesting the ongoing legacy of Molly Ivins. And let me add one more name to the list there, because I know our friend Dr. Allen from Waco, whose organization, Waco Friends of Peace, and the people who pull that together, kindly hosted me almost exactly a year ago down there to talk about mountaintop removal in the ACAC. And Dr. Allen and a contingent of the Waco Friends of Peace are bound, as we speak, for the People's Climate March in New York City. That's why I said I wanted to have a larger discussion about that, because we badly need people of goodwill to stand up and hopefully get the government to take notice. Now, Barack Obama is going to the reason this is taking place in New York City is because because there's a climate meeting of the United Nations. Barack Obama will speak at it. And if the theory is, I guess, if he's got a million people standing behind him asking for significant action on the part of the United States, maybe we'll see it. Maybe we'll see it, especially after these godforsaken midterm elections. Maybe we'll see it. Maybe we'll see some executive orders. They don't like executive orders. Let's stick some executive orders right where the sun doesn't shine on the teabaggers and break it the hell off. And that's just me being mean. And thanks. Okay, so, by the way, Robert's challenge is down to $15. We got 14 minutes to bring in $15. Texas T pointing out in the chat room, yes, Bob, we're the little liberal mammals in the Republican dinosaur reign of Texas. The comet is coming, however. The comet is coming. And I'm sorry I stopped you there, Sparky, but I just wanted to get all that done before we got the program out, finished up. But I'm sorry.
No, you were doing a promotion for my cheese, and nothing's better than somebody who's got some cheese to give a review. Sal.
Oh, hey, Sal. There? You there, Sal?
It is outstanding cheese. It's really nicely smoky. It's got a great flavor under the smoke, and it's spicy as hell, which I like.
Yeah, see, you, as I recall, Sal, you had opted for the cheese because you said that your beloved wasn't so into blazing hot things, which meant goody more for you.
Yeah, that's right. And I offered her the jalapeno pistachios, thinking that they would be too spicy for her, and I learned that they're not. And I was happy that that was a nice, you know, shared experience that we could have. But thankfully, the smoky ghost cheese is an experience that we cannot share. Or, I mean, I regret that it's an experience we cannot share.
That's called editing on the fly, Sal.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah, the reason I jumped in on the Friday on the front porch is for Sparky on what were called glaciers on Mount Shasta. There is a big difference between snowfields and glaciers. Glaciers move. Snowfields sit. And I don't think there's been a glacier on Mount Shasta in the last 20 years. There have been snowfields that lasted all summer, but they didn't move. And I could be wrong. I might need to be corrected. But a snowfield is just the snow packs into a valley, and it sits there, and then it melts and feeds the rivers and feeds the trout and the salmon and all the rest of that. Glaciers are an ice pack that actually move down a mountain. And I think the glaciers on Mount Shasta died about 20 years ago.
Back before most people were hollering climate change.
You may be right. I mean, I brought up the subject, and Asa, who's got my Skype address, he said he saw some snow fields on Shasta a couple of weeks ago. He was in Medford, Oregon, down from British Columbia visiting people, and he saw the snow fields. If you want to call them that, I don't care.
Well, but I remember back in about 1953, I went on a trip with my folks, and somewhere between Banff and Calgary, there were glaciers that came right down to the road. You got on a snowmobile, you went toward the glacier, and blah, blah, blah. And now you get in a four-wheel drive, and you drive miles to get to where the snow is. Mm-hmm. But the glaciers have stopped moving. And when a glacier stops moving, it's no longer a glacier.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was the question that I was headed for, and this is all definitional. But so is a snowfield a precursor to a glacier, or is it the sad end of one?
If we are in a cooling situation, a snowfield is a precursor. If we are in a warming situation, a snowfield is the end of, because glaciers are a pack of ice in a valley on a mountain that slide down the mountain. Yosemite National Park was formed by a glacier carving out the entire valley. The glacier receded, and for 100 years we've been playing in Yosemite Valley, but it was formed as a glacial valley. Now, glacial valleys are U-shaped because of the ice scrubbing everything out. River valleys are V-shaped. So if you're in a V-shaped valley, it's a river-created valley. If you're in a U-shaped valley, you're in a glacier-created valley.
Absolutely fascinating. And of course, anytime I think about the great glaciation, the first thing that comes to mind, the North American glaciation, the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that when that happened and when they receded and everything had been scrubbed clean, because a glacier will scrub the shit out of whatever it goes over, the North American continent was receded by the Appalachian Mountains because they had not been touched, because the glaciers couldn't overcome them. And, you know, that they stopped about central Missouri and sort of southern Pennsylvania, and this entire continent was receded in terms of plant life by the Appalachians, which is cool. And now we're blowing them up. Oh, and by the way, good news. Thanks to Ron. We've met we have met. Robert's up, over, down, under 20th of the month Australia challenge. Hallelujah. So in the next 8 minutes, if we could bring in $35, we'd fill in the hole and start fresh on Monday. I find all of the, well, I dodged chemistry and biology in college by taking geology. One, I like the topic, and B, okay, I admit, I didn't want to fool with the math. And consequently, I did considerably better at geology. And geology and geography fascinates me. To look at the glacial action, running down through, what we know as the Rockies, the Cascades, whatever. And then to think of the human impact, we still posit that humanity entered North America via the ice-free corridor. Although I think there are challenges to that now.
You mean through Alaska?
Yeah, well, during the glaciation, it takes a lot of water to cover a continent in a glacier, or in fact a globe, because glaciers were moving in Europe too. So water levels in the oceans were down considerably, and it exposed land, the theory goes, between Siberia and Alaska. The Denali dimwit actually could have walked to Alaska from her house back then, and we wish she'd try now. But, yeah, so peoples migrated across from Siberia, across the Bering Land Bridge, and down what is posited as the ice-free corridor to populate the Americas. Wow, that's our first significant silence all night long.
Everybody's trying to put together a thought. When you said,
but if there was that much ice on the continents to cover them, that land bridge would have been awfully cold to cross.
Well, yes, it would have.
Because it would require that the central North American continent and virtually all of Asia was covered with ice. And if all that was covered with ice, I mean, it may have been a land bridge, i.e. land bridge, but it would have been an ice-covered bridge.
Very likely,
and
very possibly.
If you're just walking on your feet across from Siberia to Alaska and hiking down to a place where you could pick berries in the United States, it would be one long walk, and you better have a hell of a backpack carrying food to be.
I think
able
the theory is to say that it took several generations. It wasn't one person just making the hike alone.
Yeah, it was thousands of years.
Even if it was several generations, I mean, if you're leaving Siberia and hiking across the ice, those several generations have to be eating food and making babies and taking care of babies and all the rest of that as they're crossing this
ice-infested
country.
Yeah, like the Inuit still do today. We can survive in all kinds of harsh climates.
Oh, we can survive
in harsh climates.
We're very creative, very clever primates. You know, it's that whole tool making. Well, I mean, look at the harsh winters of northern Wisconsin and the areas of Canada around the Great Lakes and Minnesota and northern Michigan. One of the things that so impressed me when I first met my friends up there was that you start looking around and you realize once you've got the weather licked, that place is paradise. The food grows in the freaking water. Deer all over. And of course, at the time we're talking about of the migration into North America, the megafauna were still here, as my anthropology professor put it. He said, Fred and Barney come walking down into North America, and hey, look, dinner.
Yeah, but the whole point is the white man wasn't taught to see that.
No. That had to be figured out much after the fact.
We just walk on by.
Hey, Sergi, I heard you there. What's up?
I was just want to quickly respond to the emailer. I don't have any insight into the Texas City incident. That was a little before my time, but I'll definitely do research into those topics, and sometime next week I'll call in.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Sergi. Well, that pretty much does it for us this evening. Thanks for a rousing good conversation. I know lots of people enjoy our Friday on the Front Porch conversation. If you're listening to this in delay or on a podcast or whatever, please know that we still have $35 to raise. Thank you to Robert for putting forward his challenge this evening. It was badly needed and much appreciated. We could not have filled in as much of the hole as we did without him. Thanks to the entire Horn Malloy Skype chat group, Friday on the Front Porch roundtable of extraordinary, ordinary, working folks. Thank you to Waggy. Thank you to Sergi. Thank you to Larry. Thanks for popping in, Roger. Thank you to Todd and Kath. Thank you, Terry. And we missed you, Carol. And hopefully one of these evenings we'll get you into the mix, M. Brandt. Looking forward to it. And you're all everybody's welcome to participate as you see fit. Just if you want to, send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc on Skype, and he'll get you into the group. And, of course, thanks always go out to Sparky, who for years and years now has moderated this Friday Night Conversation. The Friday Night Conversation will, in fact, continue at about midnight Eastern time after the close of the Friday Evening Malloy program. It's a great time to jump in. It's a rollicking conversation. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, you who contribute the money that keeps the horn going, you who contribute your time, your ideas, and you who sit and listen and enjoy. You all are what makes up this community. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Gina, always, it's all for you.